Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang. Our guest today, Dr. James Lewis, professor of history at Kalamazoo College, has written a fascinating new book about Aaron Burr titled The Burr Conspiracy, Uncovering the Story of an Early American Crisis. In the book, Dr. Lewis uses the uncertainty about Burr's intentions in the fall of 1806 and the trouble that followed to address the role of conspiracy and crisis in our young, newly developed democracy and the impact it had on politics and political culture. Dr. Lewis also looks at how biased newspaper reports, partisan politics, the federal government, and notions of honor and gentility played out in the matter of the chief villain of the Founding Fathers.
The Burr Conspiracy was a very famous moment of early American history when it seemed like the former vice president had perhaps committed treason. And so I'm very interested in how people at the time came to understand this as a treasonous event, and how they put together a story out of this swirl of conflicting rumors and accounts and reports that allowed them to move forward and to act and to put a man on trial for his life.
That, of course, was our guest today, Dr. James Lewis, who will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Program November 6th at the Ripley Center. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, we are joined today via Skype with Dr. James Lewis. Well, Dr. James Lewis, thanks very much for joining the show today.
I'm looking forward to it.
Good. Well, Dr. Lewis, Alexander Hamilton, as well as Aaron Burr, are part of pop culture today, certainly. But following the famous duel between the two men, Vice President Aaron Burr was tried for treason, and there were many other issues that surrounded him. Tell us briefly about your program, The Burr Conspiracy, which is going to be presented at the Smithsonian November 6, 2017, at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C.
Well, Burr's story for many people ends with his killing of Alexander Hamilton. It sort of ends on the dueling ground at Weehawken, New Jersey. We vaguely know, perhaps, that he was charged with both dueling and murder. He, in fact, never stood trial for either of those. What he stood trial for just 3 years later was treason. And he was charged with trying to divide the United States at the Appalachian Mountains. And he was charged by President Thomas Jefferson, who told the Congress and the nation very clearly that Burr's guilt was placed beyond question. In fact, though, Burr was found not guilty. He was acquitted. The court was under the control of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall. And so this became a very famous incident. It was a crisis building up to the trial as Americans tried to understand what Burr was doing. But then it was something of a crisis coming out of the trial as Americans, Jefferson foremost among them, tried to figure out how to move forward, what could be done now to prevent something like this from happening again, and for Jefferson in particular, what could be done to prevent the court from stepping in to save someone who, in Jefferson's mind, was certainly a traitor.
Well, your new book, The Burr Conspiracy, Uncovering the Story of an Early American Crisis, which is going to be available for purchase and signing at the event November 6th, is thorough and wonderful on many of these subjects. What surprised you most about Aaron Burr?
Aaron Burr is very hard to figure out. And that didn't surprise me. Everybody who's tried to write about him for 200 years has said that he's very hard to figure out. So part of what I tried to do was to shift the questions, to shift the attention away from Burr and what he was thinking, which is really impossible for us to figure out anymore, to the people who were living through these events and trying to make sense of them for themselves. Because after all, they had to make decisions at the time. They had to act. They had to decide what to do if they were in a position of power to do anything, or at least what to support or what to oppose if they weren't in power, if they were reacting to federal officials, state officials, territorial officials. So what I found fascinating as I was doing this was how many people talked about it. Of all walks of lives, men and women, very interesting comments from a former slave, very interesting comments from everyone all the way up to, of course, the President of the United States. And how concerned most of them were and what they were concerned about and what their fears tell us about the United States 20 years after the Constitution, 40 years essentially after the Declaration of Independence.
Well, you're referring to kind of all of these swirling things that were taking place. Of course, there are lots of parallels today, and I want to talk to you just a little bit about that. But I think for me, rumors of his daughter, and I think her name is pronounced Theodosia, is that right, approximately?
Yes.
Those were among the most bizarre, at least to me. But I was captivated by this idea of the many parallels between today's stories of fake news and all these rumors. What is your conclusion of the effect of all of this conspiracy talk, this chatter, this rumor mongering that was going on, bias, and all these other notions on the man, Burr?
Burr had a very interesting personality. He was talked about a lot. He was criticized a lot, but he was very reluctant to engage directly in defending his reputation. And for many people, that's part of what put him in such a difficult position, is he wouldn't come right out and say, all right, this is what I'm doing. It's okay. You don't need to worry about it. He would issue kind of vague declarations or not say anything and just let rumor and accusation pile up and trust that that his motives would ultimately be shown to be pure. That was not the best approach to just let the attacks continue to mount. There are a lot of parallels to the present, and in some ways, things that we think are bad now were much worse then. We often talk about the biased media, but the newspapers of 1805, 6, 7 were explicitly party newspapers, and Burr kind of fell in the cracks between the two parties and didn't have a lot of support. In time, the opposition party, the Federalists, would somewhat throw some support behind him, but for the most part, he was fair game from every side. And really experienced the problems that come with that.
Well, I have to say, again, the book is very thorough. It's also quite lengthy, 752 pages approximately. I'm curious when you started to write this, because all of what you're writing, it does very much parallel today, and you're very prescient. So your timing is perfect, Dr. Lewis. Talk to us a little bit about kind of when you started and how you knew all this.
Well, I didn't, of course, and it was all accidental. I could not have predicted either Hamilton the musical or our current political situation.
Okay, you've done well. You've done well, Dr. Lewis.
I really started this back in the late 90s. I was wrapping up my first book, and I was looking for something fresh to attack. And I got very interested in the Burr conspiracy, and I was going to do what everybody before me has tried to do, to get it right, to figure out the true story, and then to figure out an elegant way of telling it so that it would appeal to an audience beyond academia, beyond the classroom. And I set it aside for a few years. I did a couple of smaller books along the way, including one for Monticello that was very much for a popular audience. It's sold in their bookstore. And by the time I got back to it, I just had a new batch of questions. I wasn't going to try to get inside the minds of the three or four men who have always been at the center of accounts of the Burr conspiracy. I was instead going to look at these broader issues of how did people make sense of what was going on? How did people decide at the time how to act? And what does that process reveal to us about their fears and about their hopes, about how information moved at the time, about the media of the era? And those questions just seemed, in the first place, much more answerable than questions about the workings of a handful of very secretive men's minds. But it also seemed much more important. It seemed a much richer way to understand the early American Republic than to try to figure out what Burr was really up to or Jefferson was really up to. That had been tried many a time, and it doesn't tell us that much when you get right down to it.
This all really makes for a great story, but the war with Spain, Louisiana Purchase, these separatist movements being afoot, government instability, all of the fragility of our kind of our early nation at the time.
Right.
What is still unanswerable or unresolved regarding Burr and the conspiracy?
Well, I think the central question has always been, what was he doing? We know that he was moving around the backcountry, places like Western New York, Western Pennsylvania. His agents were in these areas. They were recruiting men. He was traveling along the Ohio River and the Mississippi River, and he was having boats built. He was having supplies purchased. And the question has always been, why? What was the ultimate destination of this? And there were a lot of different ideas floated at the time, and some of them were perfectly innocent. Like he was going to, this is 3 years after the Louisiana Purchase, and the idea is, well, maybe he's just going to take a group of men primarily, but families to some extent, into this new purchase and set up, in a sense, what they would have called then a colony. It wouldn't have really been a colony, but a settlement. That's perfectly innocent. Other people worried that this was really going to be a military expedition against Spain, targeting either the Floridas, which were in Spanish hands still, or Mexico and Texas. And other people worried that he was trying to divide the United States. He was trying to get the people west of the Appalachian Mountains to leave the United States and to set up an independent nation under his control. And that he could do that in either of two ways. He could do that by simply convincing them that it was in their best interest, that their interests were, in fact, very different from those of the eastern states. Or he could do it by capturing New Orleans and putting a squeeze on their commerce, because all Western commerce essentially had to go down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico. It was too expensive to carry it over the Appalachians to the eastern states. So there's a range of possibilities that were laid out at the time. There were many more. There were people who thought that he intended a coup and was going to overthrow the government and install himself in Washington, D.C. And so that question has never been resolved. It's never really been determined what he planned to do, which of those options were real options in his mind, and which of those options were simply things that were ascribed to him by outsiders in this period of crisis.
Well, Dr. James Lewis, thank you so much. This is just a fascinating subject. I think it's an important subject for our audience to do. Again, you're going to be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Program, the Ripley Center, November 6th, 2017. And you'll be hanging around a little bit after the event to sign the books for us too, right?
Absolutely.
Well, we look forward to meeting you. I'll be there. I just encourage my audience to check out the website for more information about Dr. Lewis, the book, some of his other material that he's published. And Dr. James Lewis, thanks so much for joining us today on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate it. Thanks to our guest today, Dr. James Lewis, who, again, will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Program November 6, 2017. Special thanks to the Smithsonian staff and all of the help that they give me with the interviews. As usual, we'll post links to everything about Dr. Lewis, and as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me an email at info@notold-better.com. That's info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better. That's Talk About Better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all.